Sometimes being a person with PMS and or menopause is hard. Every few weeks, there's the struggles of bloating, cravings, and an overall feeling of discomfort in our skin. But now with Happy Mammoth's Hormone Harmony, it can be easier to manage symptoms. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. The beauty of adaptogens is that they help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. Hormone Harmony can help with so many hormone-related issues. Emily has been using it, and what she has enjoyed is how it supports hormonal balance and regulation, promotes healthy weight loss, can help curb cravings, and relieve mood swings. Feeling like myself again is mentioned over and over in Happy Mammoth's reviews, and there are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code RAIN at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code RAIN for 15% off today.
It's never been easy for me to serve delicious, wholesome, homemade meals that are budget-friendly and kid-approved. At least, not until now. Gobble, my favorite meal prep kit, makes it so easy. All Gobble meal kits are designed by professional chefs and are pre-prepped. That means less work for you and less waste in your kitchen. Gobble meals include gourmet, chef-made ingredients that make cooking a breeze, from signature sauces and unique spice blends to compound butters, marinades, and reductions. With a huge range of weekly meals, Gobble makes it easy for families of all tastes and sizes to build a menu everyone will love. Childhood favorites, trending ingredients, and bold new flavors. There's always something to discover, so dinner is never boring. One of my favorite things is I can easily switch up my menu. Some days we go for family favorites, other days I'm on my own and can order lean and clean meals to ensure I hit my nutritional goals. Personally, I find Gobble to be so refreshing for a number of reasons. I'm a single mom with a teenage daughter, and we're not only trying to save money, but also reduce food waste, and she's learning how to cook. I don't want to send her off to college without the skills to feed herself, so Gobble has been the perfect way to learn new recipes and have her cook them herself. Not to mention, we have the perfect amount of ingredients for two meals, so we aren't wasting money by throwing out leftovers or buying more ingredients than we need.
See what a difference Gobble will make for your household. Right now, they're offering our listeners a fantastic limited-time deal. Get $120 off across four boxes, plus free shipping and free cookies. Just go to gobble.com/therain. That's gobble.com/therain today. This offer is not available on their home site, so do not miss out. This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
On May 4, 1938, 4 days before Mother's Day, Mary Eleanor Smith, incarcerated at the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla since 1929, attempted to smuggle out several letters she'd written. So Mary smuggling out those letters was a really risky gambit at that point because she was set to be paroled 5 days later.
Oh my, why would you do something to jeopardize that?
It's weird. Guilt?
I feel like a lot of people do that too.
Also, she was very old, and I think maybe there was some part of her that maybe didn't want out of prison.
I think of Shawshank Redemption, where some people just can't handle life out of it, and so they continually do things to keep them in prison. So that rings true.
Yeah, and I think she was just tired and in poor health, and I think being an old person in the 1930s was probably pretty tough.
Oh, yeah.
The letters were first passed to Mary Smith's cellmate, Miss Genevieve McKinney Toomey Teal Paddleford Howells Fawcett.
What?
More names.
Bless you.
I've had several people reach out to me about their favorite part being all the nicknames from
all
episode.
The monikers. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Great.
I don't mean to tongue tie you. Can you go back again?
Let's do that one more time for us.
So she was supposed to be the first link in the chain passing the letters through the prison underground. This is Mrs. Genevieve McKinney Toomey Teal Paddleford Howells Fawcett.
Is that eight names?
She was married 5 times.
Oh, and she just kept them all?
Yeah, her original
like a
name
Pokemon?
Is, yeah, she's Genevieve McKinney. But yeah, she's referred to that in the press because she was a world famous con artist and fraudster.
Oh, and she had a lot of names to work with.
Yeah, so it was sort of, I think, well, like a, I don't know, it was like a fun thing to put in the paper every time they mentioned her. It's really funny.
Except for the guy who had to lay the tiles out for the printing press.
Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh, she's like, not again. Why do you keep doing things?
And yeah, she'd been in the press for decades following her trail of arrest. She married someone, built them out of money, moved overseas, was a Broadway star, all
wow.
of this stuff. A crazy life.
Okay,
really.
I want a story on her too.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I can't even get into it because it would just take hours. So I'm going to do an episode about Genevieve McKinney.
I love
or two,
it.
Because it's Yay. a
Just to mention her name more than once, it would be a two-parter.
Well, it'll be fun, yeah, as the story goes, to add a name, add a name.
Oh my gosh, that would be funny. Or if you really are looking for your episode to be longer, you just repeat her name a lot.
Yeah, every time.
So Mary Smith entrusted these letters to her cellmate, the world-famous con artist, who immediately turned them over to authorities at the prison. The letters, intended for multiple recipients, were examined by the warden. They included detailed confessions of the murder and disposal of Jean Bassett.
Oh, my God.
Who had been missing for 10 years.
What a dum-dum to put that in a letter.
Many letters. Like several. She was sending
them to...
She's
like, hey, everybody that I know.
A
I didn't have
people.
A Christmas card this year, so let me tell you what I did. That's shocking that you could have a lifetime of crime and then you do that.
Yeah.
I wonder if she was... If a component of it was one last piece of attention, maybe.
Maybe.
As well. Because she had faded. It had been 10 years since the last time anyone really cared about it.
She wanted to be in the newspaper again.
Brought in to get yelled at by the warden, Mary Smith admitted she'd written the letters and confirmed their contents were accurate and true. She signed a formal confession a few days later. Which made sense. A confession. Even a decade after the crime. Guilt and shame grow in power over time. And 9 years of pondering one's life and crimes in a prison cell can move a person, eventually, to excrete the truth. This is a portion of one of the letters written to a man named Wheeler, whom Mary was planning to wed. I'm going to tell you the truth. An automobile was advertised for sale by Eugene Bassett. Earl, that's DeCasto Mayor, Earl answered the ad and went over to see Bassett at his sister's home. It was a most beautiful car, and he wanted it as he had 2 very good positions offered by real estate men. So this is her talking about him trying to establish himself as a regular workaday guy, but by first acquiring a vehicle so he could travel around and do
and
work,
pass more easily.
Yeah. Earl told me he was going to bring Bassett to our house the next day and do away with him. We took the Dr. Clark house for this kind of a purpose. As we knew whatever car we got, we would have to do away with the owner, and this was an ideal spot for the purpose. Earl went and got him. Earl said we could not close the deal until he spoke to his mother, and she would have to write out the check. He brought him home, and I was sitting on the couch where I had a rod of iron hidden in a quilt in case of a struggle. B, that's Bassett, sat in chair in front of fireplace. As I stepped into the kitchen, Earl stepped up behind B and handed him a blank telegram and said, I'm going to have your car, and I won't pay for it. You write this telegram as I dictate. B refused, but Earl said, you write it, or I'll kill you. So he wrote. As Earl took the telegram, he picked up a hammer and hit Bassett on the head. I heard his body fall and went in, and he was gurgling. I stepped out, and Earl gave one blow, and it was all over. We dragged the body into the bathroom, undressed it, and put the body in the bathtub, where he dissected it at once. I cleared the mess and burned the clothes, and the scalp was also burned. Earl was so sick and weak I gave him eggnog to keep him up. At night we took the pieces of the body, minus the head and hands, and drove way out to a big patch of woods somewhere between Cathcart and Bothell, and put them under some brush clump. The next morning we took the hands and head miles away to another patch of woods and buried the hands on one side of the road at a distance and the head on the other side into an old abandoned woodchuck hole at arm's length. This is all about the Bassett case.
wow, what, like, what an extreme. There's not an easier way to steal a car.
No kidding.
And he was great at stealing cars.
That's so odd that you, it's like he wanted to kill someone.
I think so. They went to great lengths after they did that.
Here, yeah, that here's seems like a lot of work.
So much work. For, I mean, I guess a pretty good payout, but.
But they could have still gotten that payout other ways, you know?
Like, just steal a car. Like, just go just hotwire
that
one.
They had to
he
have
was
it.
Good at changing the serial numbers on the car so that he could then pawn it off again. I guess maybe he, whatever the deal, he, it was hard to hang on to a car.
And that one might have been too unique to do that way.
Yeah, it was brand new. It was, yeah, gleaming blue and, yeah, in perfect shape. Mary Smith wrote further, "I want to show you how brave I was, for when Earl took the telegram downtown, I was all alone in that house with Bassett's body all cut up in the galvanized washtub in Earl's bedroom. And I often think I was not very polite to him, for I never once stepped in the room to pay my respects. And do you know how I worked to clean up all that bloody mess? And I carried it out and poured it around the grapevine so I could have plenty of grapes the next year. And they even cheated me out of even the grapes."
Jesus. Well, I'm so sorry it put you out, Mary.
Yeah. What a sicko. I'm going to have great grapes because they're so fertilized from these remains. That is foul.
The cut and dry way in which they talk about possessions exactly. and things is really chilling. She also wrote the warden, J.M. McCauley, in part, "First, I want to say, as I have confessed and told you the truth, please take that into consideration. And as I told you yesterday, these crimes were not committed from a point of maliciousness. It was just because the boy needed money or car to start life, and he never allowed his victims to suffer. I have decided to plead guilty to the murder of Bassett. I will discuss the details to the proper authorities."
Wait, so she wrote, that was one of the letters she was trying to smuggle out?
No, that was one that she then wrote to
the
warden.
Caught.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
To explain. Another force that compelled Mary Smith to pen her confession was a minister who visited with her, providing spiritual guidance. He gained her trust and through correspondence convinced her to pen the letters to unburden her soul. That would have been good for Mary, except the minister was actually a state police officer posing as a man of God. She realized he was a cop and fell to the floor in tears. The officer was able to calm her and, quote, after the interview, she wrote freely.
That is so illegal.
That's very shady.
And it comes up later in the trial, but it kind of doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
See, that's why this needs to be a movie.
This is a quote from HistoryLink. "On Thursday morning, May 5th, Warden McCauley brought Smith and Mayer together for a face-to-face confrontation in the presence of Chief of Detectives Ernest W. Yoris, Seattle Police Department, and King County Deputy Prosecutor John M. Shermer. After hearing Smith recount the details of Bassett's murder, Mayer denied the charges and said she was insane. His actual quote was, you're crazy, Ma. But later that day, Smith's confession was read back to him, and he admitted that it was correct. Although Mayer refused to make a written confession, on Saturday, May 7th, he voluntarily signed the following statement. After discussion with Warden McCauley and after seriously considering the situation, I have decided to plead guilty to the murder of Bassett. I will disclose the details to the proper authorities. Inadvertently, Mayer had adopted Smith's confession as his own. Although he later repudiated it, the document became admissible as evidence against him in trial. Mary Smith's confession further buried herself and her son by admitting their responsibility for two similar murders committed many years earlier in a little place called Anaconda, a mining boomtown originally called Copperopolis. The area, located 24 miles northwest of Butte, was at its peak in the early 1920s, with the Anaconda Copper Mining Company expanding globally, snapping up mines all over the world. One could see the allure of Anaconda for habitual criminals DeCasto Mayer and Mary Smith. It was a place where riches poured from the earth. The Anaconda mine and its smelter were shut down in 1980. Efforts to decontaminate Anaconda and its surrounding areas continue to this day, but the place is not without its beauties. You can visit the tiny Anaconda Smokestack State Park, the jewel of which is a 585-foot-tall brick monolith with a 75-foot diameter. It is taller than the Washington Monument by 30 feet and sits among hills and roads, and Ace Hardware and Subway. From the sky, it looks like the mayor's hat in The Nightmare Before Christmas. You know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Biggest stovepipe hat?
That's right.
On October 16, 1926, an article in the Anaconda Standard details the arrest of a man for squatting in an abandoned house at 623 East Commercial Avenue. Iris Smith, recently paroled from the state prison, had nowhere else to go. And happy to have a roof over his head, paid no mind to the rumors it was haunted. He was sent to the county jail and back to prison on a parole violation, as he was found with property stolen from around the neighborhood. The structure was demolished by the Urban Renewal Agency in 1974, and the address presently looks like a house's grassy side yard with a couple of short trees and an American flag flying from a Golden Eagle-topped flagpole. It was probably a tough sell after it was first vacated in 1921 because locals, the police, and the state all believed the modest home was the site of at least two murders. In separate incidents, both a young woman and an older man walked through the front door and never reemerged, seemingly swallowed into oblivion. Dorothy LaCasse of Texas had been missing since March 1921. She was 23 and had been married to one Ernest LaCasse since December 1920. Ernest, who worked as a taxi driver in Butte, accused a man named C.C. Skidmore of killing Dorothy. And remember that Skidmore was an alias used by DeCasto Mayer. Dorothy LaCasse and Mayer had a history. In 1917, they, along with Dorothy's previous husband, Ira Petrie, were arrested for auto theft south of Butte in Dillon, Montana. Mayer was sent to Deer Lodge Prison on a 4.5 to 9 year sentence for that theft. And when he was paroled in 1920, he stole a car and drove to Washington to meet up with Dorothy LaCasse, who had just moved there from Montana so her new husband, Ernest, could enter a sanitarium, likely for alcohol dependency. DeCasto Mayer, now violating his parole for leaving Montana, believed Dorothy had ratted him out to the cops. He found her at a hotel, cornered her in a room, and, quote, beat her severely. DeCasto Mayer then returned to Anaconda, and that fall made the acquaintance of a man named Ole Larson, who was in his mid-60s. I think it's a Swedish name, O-L-E, which I think means old. So it's just like, it might have been even kind of a nickname. I don't know. Ole Larson or Old Larson. He was described as a recluse who lived in a cabin near Brown's Quarry, 5 miles outside of Anaconda. They got into some sort of business together and sold off some oil stocks they'd acquired. Both of them were flush with cash, so Mayer invited him to his and his mother's home for a celebratory dinner. That evening was the last time Ole Larson was seen. Called the House of Mysteries in the Montana Standard, the home was described as having rooms with dingy floors, padded walls, entry buzzers, peepholes drilled in walls and doors, as well as rooms that locked from the outside. A few days after Ole Larson was almost certainly murdered by Mayer and Smith, a bank draft for $750 was cashed from a bank in Butte. The Ole Larson signature on the draft was found to be a forgery. There was also a phone call placed to the hotel where Larson was staying for a time. The anonymous woman told the landlady who picked up that Larson was traveling and would return in several days. He did not return. DeCasto Mayer was then somehow able to convince Dorothy LaCasse to leave her husband in Seattle to join him in Montana, under the pretense that she was going to move in with her mother-in-law in Butte. It is a near certainty that she too entered the Mayer-Smith home and was disappeared by the pair. One of her last confirmed movements was purchasing a train ticket from Seattle to Butte on January 29th, 1921. Police later learned Mayer had boarded the same train and then that he and Dorothy had spent the next couple of days in Butte before moving on to Anaconda, where Dorothy was last seen around town through the first days of February. No alarm was raised until Dorothy's husband, Ernest, returned to Montana to find his wife missing. Police, now attuned to Mayer's possible involvement in Dorothy being missing, investigated the house on East Commercial and found, quote, jewelry, furs, baggage, and even underwear belonging to LaCasse in the Mayer Smith home. There was sufficient evidence to prosecute for murder, with but one exception. There was no corpus delicti. Sufficient evidence the crime actually occurred. Investigators even found a blood-soaked quilt during their search, and the blood was tested and found to be human.
Is this because they didn't have her body?
Correct.
Okay.
And I guess, yeah, that was all circumstantial. Having the stuff, even the blood, all of it is not enough. Right, for a connection.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Mayer was arrested for possession of her stolen property on April 1st. It was the only way to hold him while the search for Dorothy LaCasse or her remains continued. Mayer's story was that he was holding onto Dorothy's property as collateral on a $1,200 loan he'd given her for her travels. He said Dorothy was heading to Canada for no particular reason, and that's where she should be. On April 11th, 1921, The charge against Mayer was dismissed under a writ of habeas corpus, which is to combat unlawful detention or illegal imprisonment. The complaint must be specific and state the nature of the stolen property, and the successful argument by the defense attorney was that the complaint didn't achieve that. As Mayer left the courtroom, he was arrested by federal agents on auto theft charges and extradited to Utah. On May 16th, those charges were dismissed by U.S. Commissioner Van Etten because the occurrence of a crime could not be proven. Several weeks after Dorothy LaCasse was last seen, her mother, Mrs. J.A. Hendricks of Texas, traveled to Anaconda to speak with Mary Smith about the disappearance. With Mary Smith's continued denial of involvement in her daughter's vanishment, the conversation became a screaming match and then a one-sided gunfight when Mrs. Hendricks pulled a revolver from her purse and shot Mary Smith twice, once in the left forearm and once in the chest.
Whoa.
Mary Smith was badly injured but recovered in the hospital. She chose not to press charges for the shooting, which is odd, almost like she was avoiding further scrutiny.
Yeah, so that no one goes, so why were you guys arguing?
Mrs. Hendricks was allowed to take her daughter's possessions back to Texas. During the time of the alleged murders of Ole Larson and Dorothy LaCasse, as detailed in the book 10,000 Public Enemies, quote, neighbors had noticed an offensive smoke which came from the Mayer chimney. Mary Smith volunteered to a neighbor that she was burning some bones left over from meat, which she did not wish to throw into the garbage can. Police worked on the theory that both Larson and the Seattle woman, LaCasse, had been slain, their bodies chopped up, and the flesh destroyed by acid. They could not prove it. In a similar article, unquote, from the Montana Standard, almost coincident with Larson's disappearance, Skidmore, Mayer, appeared at a tin shop in Anaconda and had a copper vat constructed. A few nights later, neighbors were awakened, this time by a sickening odor, a dense volume of black smoke pouring from the chimneys. Lights were still burning in the house.
Yeah, so they think it was them burning the bodies?
Yeah, melting them.
Yeah, I feel like that's a very distinct smell.
Melting the flesh and burning the bones, I think. October 4th, 1921, Mayer, using his C.C. Skidmore alias, was arrested in Pocatello, Idaho, for receiving stolen property and transporting stolen cars across the state line. As he was led to the station, he broke away from the officers and fled through a hail of their gunfire into a rail yard. Pursued by the officers, Mayer was shot in the arm as he escaped and was rearrested several hours later, badly wounded and hiding underneath the car he stole, which was stored in a garage. Mayer was also charged with bootlegging. There was probably a trunk full of hooch.
Yeah, this is Shoebox Annie we're talking about.
He survived being shot a bunch and recovered, but not fully. He lived in a physically weakened state for the rest of his life. Hence the eggnogs.
Gotta get that protein.
Gotta get that. On Halloween 1921, the Butte Daily Post reported a conversation between DeCasto Mayer and Sheriff Beal. Beal said, I've come to take you back to Montana. Mayer asked, for murder? And Beal said, yes. Mayer asked if they found the body, and when Beal said, sure, he asked if the body was all found in one location. Beal responded, no. And Mayer asked if they found enough to identify the body. When Beal said, sure, again, Mayer turned to one of the local officers and pleaded for him to be sent to Utah, where he would face auto theft charges.
In hopes of delaying a trial. Okay.
Which is what I kind of went into, I think, in part one.
Yeah.
I kind of mentioned that. In November 1921, facing those federal charges in Utah, DeCasto Mayer pleaded guilty, receiving a sentence of up to 10 years. He received nothing for this plea deal aside from waylaying extradition to Montana, where a possible murder charge awaited him in the death of Dorothy LaCasse. He feared the hangman's noose. The skeleton of a female was found Sunday, May 27, 1923, on a mountaintop near Homestake, outside of Butte. Quote, it was recalled by Paul Quesnels, who discovered the skeleton, that more than a year ago in his rambles through the mountains, he had on various occasions come across a woman who roamed through the canyons and up the mountainsides, shrieking as if demented. When he approached her, she screamed and ran farther back into the hills. The skeleton was not Dorothy LaCasse and remained unidentified. Isn't that crazy about that woman?
That's very weird.
Ugh. It's like something out of Pumpkinhead 2 Blood Wings, right, Leash?
That's right.
That's right. I told you all about that movie. Very scary. June 28th, 1924, a boy in Basin, Montana, waiting for a friend on the side of the road, found a skeleton buried underneath a pile of rocks. The bones belonged to a female. The skull was crushed. She'd been killed with a blow to the head. These bones could not be identified. 3 months after their discovery, the skeleton was buried without a name at the cemetery in Boulder, Montana. Had they been the remains of Dorothy Lacasse, DeCastomare was to be transferred immediately from prison in Colorado to Montana to face a murder trial. DeCastomare spent the next several years in and out of prisons in Montana, Colorado, Idaho, Utah, and Kansas. He moved to the Seattle area after his July 1928 parole from Leavenworth Federal Prison. I'm not going into that time because I covered those events in part one. This covers the events in between the ones I detailed last week. In 1929, DeCastomare and Mary Smith were imprisoned in the penitentiary in Walla Walla, Washington, for the grand larceny of Gene Bassett's Chrysler Roadster, as well as many of his valuables. Mary was serving 8.5 years, and DeCasto was serving life as a, quote, habitual criminal. Last week, we talked about vicious giant salamanders, and in this episode, there are no aquatic monster attacks, but we are briefly floating back toward the supernatural realm. In 1936, Stephen Sekfu, a ferry boatman, identified Mayer and Smith through photos as a pair that he transported across the Columbia at Hanford in central Washington at daybreak on a fall morning in 1928. He described the stolen blue roadster and said during the journey, Mayer and Smith had dropped a canvas-wrapped package tied with rope into the water. King County Deputy Prosecutor Edward E. Henry and Benton County Sheriff A.M. Richter questioned DeCastomare and Mary Smith about this at the Washington State Penitentiary. Both denied taking that ferry ever. And that was pretty much that. Didn't go anywhere further. And then I said that thing about the supernatural. And this is, again, about the guy who was the ferry boatman. Quote, fear of being killed kept 59-year-old Sekfu silent, he told the sheriff. But belief that mysterious lights from behind the foothills of the Columbia were caused by Bassett's restless spirit finally caused him to talk. Quote, motorists on highways in this vicinity have reported seeing lights race along the roads and then mysteriously vanish. And another quote here from the Olympian, residents of the Ringgold District, where Sekfu operates his ferry, said the lights were seen frequently on foggy nights and probably were swamp gas.
Hmm.
So thanks to those swamp beefers, Sekfu tried to come forward, though nothing came of it. Seattle Chief of Detectives Ernest Yoris and County Prosecutor B. Gray Warner interviewed Mary Smith on May 24, 1938, weeks after her confession letters came to light. Asked to detail the murder of Dorothy Lacasse, she told them, quote, Earl brought Dorothy Lacasse home and she stayed all night. The next morning, sometime before noon, Earl shot her while she was still in bed. I went in and Dorothy was lying on the bed in a nightgown. I went to the store and when I returned, Earl had carried Dorothy out to the kitchen. We packed her over close to the sink and Earl started to dissect her. After dark, we put part of the body in a suitcase and wrapped up the rest. We broke the skull up into small pieces and took it all out to Earl's car. We drove 1.5 miles toward Butte, where a ditch runs from the Anaconda Smelter toward Warm Springs. We threw the packages in there.
And this is the woman that has been missing?
The one from Seattle, yeah. The one that DeCastomare was involved with the auto theft years before. He thought she ratted on him.
Gotcha.
Went to Seattle and beat her. She came back to Montana and vanished. Regarding the fate of Ole Larson, Mary Smith further spilled the beans. She told her interviewers that Earl took Larson into the bedroom and pulled out a gun. Quote, Earl cut it up, and the next night we drove out to the ditch and dropped it in.
It being her.
It being Larson. Mary Smith's attempt to purge her soul with honesty got herself and her son put on trial for the first-degree murder of James Eugene Gene Bassett. They would face trial for the other murders, that of Ole Larson and Dorothy Lacasse, if any inculpatory evidence was unearthed. At trial, which began on November 28, 1938, testimony from a man named Schmidt and his son revealed that, quote, on the evening of the day of Bassett's disappearance, they were driving along the Bothell Highway when a roadster bearing a Maryland license passed them at high speed. The roadster attempted to make a turn onto a dirt road, but slid into a ditch. Schmidt stopped and directed a spotlight into Mayer's face. He and his son were able positively to identify Mayer and Mrs. Smith. In the trunk of the roadster were several gunny sacks covered with red stains, which Schmidt's son said looked like dried blood. Schmidt said the sacks appeared stained with paint or blood, and that one bundle was not solid enough. It wobbled a little, like jelly. Oof. Tied to the side of the roadster was a shovel. Mayer backed out of the ditch and disappeared down a lonely road. Schmidt took the license number, and it proved to be the number on record for Bassett's Chrysler Roadster. I believe last week I mentioned some huge tongs DeCasto Mayer had made.
Yes.
Here is their disturbing description printed in the Seattle Star. Mayer admitted ownership of the handmade iron device constructed in such a manner that the grasp or loop of the tongs was roughly the same size and shape as a human neck. Holes had been punched in the handles and an iron pin dangled from a wire attached to the tongs, leading officials to believe this was a device intended to lock the tongs once they had grasped an object. Alicia and I were talking about this, that maybe it was used to pin down a limb. And then I know they dissected the bodies with usually a saw and a meat, you know, big butcher knife.
That would allow you to do it alone, which he was doing.
Yeah. Yeah. She couldn't help him. So, yeah, he could leverage, use that as like a lever and then cut the body
apart. It's really disturbing to think about, but it is logical.
Yeah. Remember Mrs. Genevieve McKinney Toomey Teal Paddleford Howells Fawcett?
I certainly do.
Never forget her.
Not by name.
She testified on December 7th, detailing an oral confession Mary Smith made to her in prison, which matched the letters Mary had written.
But weren't they from her, too? So much information.
Yeah, she turned in the letters, probably
said,
read the letters.
Oh, and she told
yeah.
me.
So
that's questionable.
She liked attention.
Yeah.
Miss Genevieve McKinney Toomey Teal Paddleford Howells Fawcett.
I can't believe you've gotten that down so well.
I've read it a bunch. It was reported on Monday, December 12th, 1938, that DeCasto Mayer had died from suicide the day before. From the death record and a report in the Miami Herald, Mayer was found suffocated with wads of paper stuffed in his nose and mouth, a strip of his shirt tied around his mouth, a belt cinched on his neck, and his hands tied together.
That's horrible.
Yeah. A huge gash on his forehead looks like he passed out before dying and struck his head.
Oh.
The body of DeCasto Mayer was cremated 2 days later. He was 44.
Oh, that's so disturbing.
There's an image in my sources of DeCasto Mayer on a gurney after he was collected, because he was found about an hour after he died.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see just the extreme nature of what he was doing.
Yikes.
And I would say kind of the, like, the mania behind it,
mm-hmm.
almost, because it seems very urgent. And I love that. All those years of committing how many crimes, stealing how many cars, killing how many people in horrible ways. And the second he has to own up to it.
Well, they'd already been in jail for 10 years, but not for that, for the murder or the murders. There was even another murder that I didn't have a chance to get into. Of a friend of Mayer's that vanished as well, the same year or the year before,
oh,
Dorothy Lacasse and Ole Larson. So it was just constant.
That's what I mean. It's like you had yeah. all this and you're already in prison. Why that? Like, why now? Or I guess 10 years was too much.
And he'd been in prison most of his life by this point. He was 44 and he'd been in prison probably 20 years
wow.
or so. Or I guess not most, but a lot of his life. When Mary Smith pleaded guilty to the murder of Jean Bassett, Mrs. Marion Bassett, the victim's mother, took the stand for a brief period and pleaded for mercy for the aged murderess. The jury was impressed with her testimony. 2 days after viewing the body of DeCasto Mayer, Smith was sentenced to life imprisonment. In April of 1949, interest in the Jean Bassett case was briefly renewed when a headless skeleton was found in a remote area 20 miles east of Seattle, near Falls City. Seattle criminologist Luke S. May doubted it was Bassett because the skeleton had intact hands. And Mary Smith admitted her son had dismembered the body completely before its disposal. These bones remained unidentified. 86-year-old Mary Smith was paroled from prison in March of 1953. She was in poor health and sent to a hospital better equipped than the Penn's infirmary to help her out. After she improved, Mary Smith was sent to live in various nursing homes. She died in 1966 at age 100.
Wow.
On December 7th, 1960, a skeleton was found which police believed could be that of Dorothy Lacasse, who'd been missing from Anaconda, Montana since 1921. The remains were found under a building on First Avenue in Seattle by a plumber cutting a hole in the concrete floor.
Whoa.
There was a bullet hole in the skull. A composite sketch based from the skull was sent to authorities in Montana, but nothing came from it. It doesn't really look like any of the photos I've seen of Dorothy Lacasse. And you can see the sketch and photos of Dorothy Lacasse in my sources. By Christmas Eve of that year, a few weeks later, the Jane Doe skeleton case had been filed away with other inactive cases because of a lack of evidence. And there was no more movement on that ever. And that's it. Questions?
Just crazy. They were like Bonnie and Clyde, but
mother and son.
but mother and son.
I feel like in these older stories, that's kind of the case. It's like criminal raises criminal. It reminds me of that the Goonies family.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
The Petrellis?
Totally.
Wait, no, the Fratellis.
The Fratellis. Yeah.
Family was probably the only thing you could trust.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or think you could trust.
Well, you don't know any different, too. If your mom's a criminal and that's who raised you.
Yeah.
You don't know any difference.
Wow.
So, yeah, super criminals, super guilty.
Really gnarly stuff, though. Like, I just feel like they chose to be more horrible than they even needed to be.
They could have just, if they had just killed people and
disposed
and
of
just,
their body.
Yeah, just take it out into the wilderness and dump it. Yeah, they didn't have
For back then, they still wouldn't have caught you,
There's
probably.
No way.
It's just the,
There's
you
no
want
way.
The car, yeah. So you like, well, I got to murder him.
Yeah.
Got to kill
you
him.
You can't find one.
You can't just
or...
like dump him in the woods somewhere, or hit, you know, like.
It's weird.
They or were... just hold him up at gunpoint and take the
get,
car.
Get a head start. It's so weird.
Well, it was dumb, too, because they made so much contact when they were getting the car from Jean Bassett.
Right.
With his sister, his brother-in-law.
Like everyone knew that they had been the last people.
Yeah. And actually, I found out in this when I was doing the work for this episode that when DeCastomere went to see the car the first time, he brought Mary Smith with him. So they everyone had seen them. Everybody.
Wow.
And then they disappeared him the next day. They knew.
Right.
Everyone always knew, but they just didn't have the evidence. So, yeah.
They well, were I'm good glad they were held responsible stuff. For some of the things they did.
Yeah.
At least. And he was given a life sentence.
Yeah. We don't see that happen always, so.
Wow.
Yeah.
And well, although she accidentally admitted it.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, that was just nuts, too. She was trying to get married behind bars. She was like 73 or something like that. It was just, she never stopped, I guess. I would think.
Yeah.
And I would think that that marriage that she was trying to get going was probably in efforts to get some sort of bilking going out of that
man.
Yeah,
so, definitely.
Yeah. It was a real gripping case. And I did way too much research.
Oh, great. I look forward for more sources to add to the giant 3 pages of sources that I formatted for an hour.
Well, thank you. I got 3 more for you. Sorry.
It's me, Miley.
Reach around into the past. I will bring you mine, or if you want to come visit me while I'm dying.
Obviously. You're not dying. Don't
you can
even
pick
put
them
that
up
into the universe. How dare you?
You have to survive, Em.
I will.
Because I have to see them.
You have to see my boobies?
And maybe give them a squeeze if you're down.
I'm going to be showing them
all.
Oh,
yeah. He said he was like, he was like, would that be okay? Is that weird if I'm so
everybody's
curious.
Gonna want to.
He's like, I'm so curious what an updated version of a fake booby feels
like. Yeah,
it's
like. Been 20 years since I felt a fake tit.
Yeah, I'll have everyone gather around and get a little squeeze once they're healed.
There's a part where he gets arrested, and when they take him into jail, they examine his clothes, and he had like 6 files and
no!
saws.
No! Oh my God,
sewed,
I knew it.
Sewn into his clothing.
They need a movie about these people.
It's a remarkably vast case. I seriously was talking with Alicia yesterday about it, how it could be a book, and maybe I'll
do
that because there's enough. There's so much I had to cut out so much just to make it.
You should do that
anyways,
as your side project.
I might do that. It's a really good case. All right. The letters intended for
multiple recipients.
Across the Mississippi River.
Mississippi River.
Multiple recipients.
God damn it. Written to a man named Wheeler, whom Mary was planning to wed. Is that okay?
Yeah, that was better.
Yeah. Not good, but better.
My anaconda don't want none unless you got one.
That was good.
That was.
Well, I've heard that song a lot. Every morning.
What?
Bump, 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 bump. That's how I wake up.
Your alarm music?
Bump, 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 bump. Efforts to decontaminate. It is a stunner of a brick dick jutting from the land's grassy crotch.
What the fuck?
Every place is full of murderers.
That's right.
Look out.
So move wherever you want, everyone.
It doesn't matter. Either you are or you aren't going to
Crime
get...
reports don't matter.
Nope. It is a near certainty that she was...
Leavenworth Federal Prison.
You like swamp beefers?
Yeah.
Well, get ready.
Oh, boy.
Oh, we got a really cute Patreon comment.
Oh.
From Ellen. It says, I just became a patron and have never heard these stories. You're all so funny. Kudos to you three.
Wow. That's true. Mrs. Genevieve McKinney Toomey Teal Paddleford. Wait. Interest in the Jean Bassett case. Jesus Christ. Mississippi River.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderinTheRain.
And suck my balls.